In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Jim Hoffman here for EMS Office Hours.
Josh Knapp.
Josh.
How you doing tonight, Jim?
Okay. Hopefully, we can get a few people in the chat and calling in tonight, as usual. But I do want to mention, of course, a sponsor. We are sponsored by EMS Manager. Go check out EMS Manager. They are at emsmanager.net. You can get a free trial of some pretty cool software there, and you can use it for employee scheduling and management. So go check them out, emsmanager.net. Josh, I also want to mention Wantando before we get too far into the show tonight as well, because I know you've got two sort of new things on the site. Well, not new to the site, not new things, I guess, and new items, but you've got a new sort of shopping cart software going on there, which I think makes it a little bit easier for people to see what to buy and make the whole process a little more user-friendly, I think.
Yeah, you know, I had to streamline it. It was getting a little awkward. It wasn't generating the right results and stuff like that. So this should be a little bit better.
I went over that, checked it out. I mean, it flows pretty good.
Cool.
And I like the way that it kind of gives people sort of some suggestions as they go along to maybe pick up a carabiner or the pouch, you know, for the wrench or something like that, which is pretty cool. So, you know, anyone out there that has not seen a Wantando wrench, go to the site. It's wantando.com, wantando.com. Or also, what is it, o2wrench.com as well, right, Josh?
O2wrench and oxygenwrench.com.
Any one of those will get you to the right place.
Get you to the right place. That's right.
So go check that out. There's actually some there's pictures there. You can get a closer look at it. I know a lot of times people see it on Facebook, and I know we have sort of the graphics flowing by here in Blog Talk Radio too, but I think sometimes go and visit the actual website and seeing some of the pictures, you know, up close is kind of cool. Give people a little bit of a better perspective on what it is that
there's some demos.
Exactly. The video is there and stuff. You know, the video of the window breaking and all that stuff. So it's definitely worth a visit.
Yeah. You know what? I had I don't want to belabor the point here,
sure.
But I had an interesting
hog up the whole show.
Hog up the whole show. Yeah. But you know what? It's like when we talk about this stuff, we usually think EMS-centric. You know, it's EMS. And I got a guy calling me the other day, really thankful for the way the wrench was designed, and he was getting some because he's taking care of his mother-in-law, who's in a nursing facility for CA patients. And they're always letting the oxygen run out, and he's going in and finding that he has to change the regulators all the time because the people there just don't seem to know how to do it. And he says that the wrench really makes the job that much easier. And it was really kind of cool to hear from somebody who's completely not connected to EMS but has to use the O2 that I've made a tool that helps their lives too. So just a little side point.
Yeah, I mean, listen. People don't listen. We got a couple minutes, I guess, before we get too much into the show, I guess. But I think it's important to know too that while you do a lot of stuff for the EMS world with the wrenches, but I mean, you know, people have home oxygen. It's the type of thing that can work as well, because then you've got grandma who, you know, can't use the cheap plastic ones that they give them and stuff.
Doesn't have the strength, have the leverage.
Because people don't realize there's a little bit of ergonomics that go into it. You know what I mean? And
a lot of ergonomics.
Yeah.
So a lot of time went into it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I've actually left one or two with some patients, you know, and I know we're about to get into this because I hear the resonance off the title, you know, the bullshit calls, and I hear the resonance. But, you know, you probably have them as much as I do, Jim, you know, one or two frequent flyers who aren't there for any other reason than really freaking bad luck. And they're not calling you for bullshit. They're calling you because they're, you know, pulmonary hypertension, or they
right.
have HIV acquired by, you know, somebody who freaking gave it to them, not through, you know, other means, if that makes a freaking difference when you have those diseases. But they're there, they need your help, and they're calling you. And, you know, they're an important part of our lives because our demeanor when we go in to help those people who probably don't want to see us any more than we want to see them mm-hmm. really makes a big difference.
Well, here's the thing, I mean, and this is something that I guess
soapy, sappy on you.
I know. Well, I kind of get a little torn when I think about this topic. And when I say the word, you know, bullshit call, it's not really with the patient it's not the frequent flyer that calls because they're abusing EMS. You know, there's not a lot we can do about that, and it's hard to sort of, you know, learn to love that or learn to, you know, look forward to that type of call that you get. You know, because to me, I'm thinking of bullshit call, and a little bit along the lines that you said, you know, people who are sort of a frequent flyer, but they are because they have no choice, and they don't want to see us. They don't want to call 911, right? But they don't have a choice to do it. But in essence, it's not necessarily an emergency. They have no other options. They don't know what else to do. You know,
right.
So for them, we are their only option on getting medical care or getting to the hospital, whatever the case may be. And sometimes people do feel, I think, in those situations also that, you know what, they know they don't, even they know they don't need the hospital, but they can't get to, you know, a doctor or a clinic and things like that. And they know that by, at least if they get to the emergency room, from there they can go to other facilities a little easier than going there from home, going there from the third floor, second floor, walk up from a high-rise building. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's an element of that. And, yeah, you know, for us, it is bullshit, right? It's a bullshit call. But I think we can't even learn to even love these calls. I think, you know, to me, there's another level of it as well, is the people who should know better, who do have other means to get to hospitals. You know, the ones that you get there and it's, let's say, it's, you know, they fell and they hurt their arm or they hurt their shoulder or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, the family is
in a freaking car. And
right. And the family follows you to the hospital in the car. And all the way to the hospital, you go in your back window and you see the family's, you know, not only just following the ambulance, but they're up your ass all the way to the hospital, you know, trying to keep pace with you. And you're not even going lights and sirens to the hospital. And then if you go, you know, happen to go to a light, the light's turning yellow, instead of them waiting like you would have if you, you know, had hit the red light, they gun it and go through the light just so they don't lose you. Like something special is going to happen, you know, if you get there, you know, 5 minutes before they do.
I'm sure you do the same thing I do, is tell family members don't follow the, you know, give them the little lecture. The most dangerous thing you can do is follow an ambulance, and you get it, and they go, yeah, and they get it anyway, and they do it anyway.
Of course,
it's just freaking making our jobs more dangerous.
Yeah, well, especially when, I mean, that's not even just for, like, the calls that are really non-emergent. Even the emergency calls where you get the cardiac arrest and you tell them, listen, we're doing everything, blah, blah, blah. Don't follow the ambulance. Don't come up behind us. Don't whatever. Don't go through the lights. You know, they still don't listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people feel that they have an entitlement to do that. I just feel it. Just they get caught up in what is, in essence, I guess it's their emergency at the time. You know what I mean?
I'm sorry, your poor planning doesn't constitute an emergency on
yeah,
my part.
right, exactly. But, you know, the calls too, though, where when I say learning to sort of love them and learning to sort of accept these calls, which are the ones that, you know, it's sort of that borderline type of thing where they don't really need an ambulance. They probably could take, you know, a private vehicle or something like that, or have somebody help them get to the hospital. And what do? Because of protocols or because of
We don't fucking have a choice. How about that?
Exactly.
I know you wanted to say it, and you're not going to say it the way I'm going to say it. That's why you have me on the show, so I'll just say it. Because we don't fucking have a choice.
Well, I mean, it's not just the choice of the transport. It's also the choice of what we're doing. I mean, how many patients do you get? You get elderly patient who, you know, is sick or whatever, and you take them to the hospital. But because of, you know, protocol, because of their age and their medical history, you sort of now you feel obligated that you have to start working the patient up. You have to start putting them on the monitor and starting an IV. And you're not giving them anything. You're not doing anything for them. It's like you're just sort of working them, you know, at the basic, you know, ALS critical care type thing, you know, because now they're in your care, because they're a patient of yours.
And we've talked about that. That's the combination 5 cc's of life, and that's covering your ass.
Right.
And actually, Jim, you know, let me put it to you this way. Do we really have a choice in that as well? Because we are, as much as we get into this thing where protocols are guidelines and everybody, you know, sits there on their high horse and says, well, protocols are guidelines, go outside the protocols and see where it gets you.
See what happens. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I mean, listen, there's ways, I guess, to document everything appropriately and not have to do that. And there's ways to explain things to patients and doctors and, you know, the QA, QI, police and all that good stuff. But the bottom line is what happens. We've talked about this before in the show, that a lot of times we'll do things, or, you know, providers will do stuff because it's just easier. It's easier to go ahead and just start the line and do the EKG and stuff, whether or not, and again, because you're not, what you're doing is not going to make any benefit for the patient one way or the other. If anything, you're starting a line and causing pain to the patient unnecessarily when they don't really need it, you know. And it turns out, you know, that it's just easier to do that than sit there and take your paperwork and say, okay, now I have to justify why I didn't put him on the monitor. You know, this elderly person who, you know, was feeling weak, you know, and whatever, and they've been sick for a couple of days. Why didn't I put them on the EKG? Why didn't I start the line? Why didn't I do a finger stick? All these types of things. For what is basically a sick call that you're not going to do anything for the patient, you know, and pretty much they would probably benefit more from, you know, kind words than a pillow than anything else.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you know, listen, every patient's different, and we have to make those judgment calls on who we work up and who we don't. And listen, there are times when I look at patients and, yeah, I say to myself, okay, you know what, maybe there's not much going on with this patient, but I'll work them up, because it's not so much a cover my ass type thing as it is I get being doing this for X amount of years. I, you know, you sort of get that sixth sense that, okay, you know what, I think working them up and giving them the line and giving them the gene stuff can end up benefiting them a little bit when they get to the hospital. There'll be sort of a head start going on, you know, before you get
there. Well, you know, that also comes from experience. You know, you pretty much know what these people are going to get in the hospital. You know, and, you know, at a certain point, they're going to pretty much do the EKG whether you do one or not. But they're going to start a line, and, you know, a lot of times this is where if you have the practice, you have the skill, you're actually saving them a little bit of pain and a little bit of suffering along the way by, you know, giving them an IV that
think about it, though.
The hospital will use.
Think about how many times have you had patients who have said to you, you go to start the line on them, right? And they're it's not really an emergency call. It's not this big emergency going on. But you're going to work them up because of their age, their medical history, and whatever, right?
Right.
And they say to you, oh my God, you know, the hospital, they never, then they can never get the line. They can never get the IV. They stick me 100 times. They do this, they do that. And then you go and do it. You get it the first time. And they're like, wow, you got it the first time in the back of a moving ambulance. And it's sort of like that experience where it does end up kind of helping them a little bit, because now they're not going to get poked 3, 4, 5 times by somebody in the hospital.
Well, they're still going to get poked, but, you know.
Yeah, but.
At least, right.
You know.
To some extent, you're saving them some pain.
Right.
And I've actually had patients go, listen, just, why don't you do it? Because they never seem to be able to get it.
Yeah.
You know, and those are your frequent flyers that sort of know the scoop, know what's going on. And, you know, that's the good. You know, those are frequent flyers I can handle, though, Jim. I mean, I sort of get from the way you put, you know, spun the title on this show, was these are, we're not talking about the frequent flyers that make our job bearable, you know, or that we can at least justify that what we're doing or justify the transport.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ones that you go, what, are you freaking kidding me? Why are you, you know, this is just abuse of the system. What the hell are you doing?
Yeah. And like I said, unfortunately, we end up, you know, kind of having our hands tied a little bit. But I think, you know, when I say things like learning to love it, right, and to me, I think, and this is something I talk about a lot of times when I do my little podcast during the week and things, and I kind of talk a little bit about how we can learning to love it in a way that we're learning from those calls, that we can sort of take the time to look for that difficult IV. We can take the time to do a assessment on somebody that can sort of hone our skills a little bit when we get the more critical calls, don't you think? And not to say they're guinea pigs, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not even sure I look at it that way. I mean, you're not really – I don't think you're – I think every time you do your skills, whether it's on a critical job or a non-critical job, you know, you're honing your skills. Every time you use your skills. So – and we all know that their skills deteriorate over time without use. So it's always important to sort of keep them limber, keep them going – you know, do the 12 leads, read the EKGs, interpret the stuff. And,
right.
And I think it's always important to do that. Now, whether somebody's, you know, I know you hesitate to use the word guinea pig, but whether somebody's actually there as for you to test your attempts on.
Yeah.
I
hate to put it that way, you know.
I'm trying to
walk the line here a little bit, you know. But
right.
I don't want to make it seem like that's the way I'm looking at these patients. But I do think that, you know, if all we did was all critical calls, I mean, how much experience and how much real hands-on stuff would we end up having? You know, if all we had was, I mean, think about how the last time you had a critical call that you had to really, you know, do all the different skills and along with an assessment, doing everything all at once. You know,
right.
how much more smoother does it go because you got experience, you know, doing the same things for patients that aren't critical, that are your run of the mill sort of calls, you know.
I think there's no doubt that when you have a patient that's not critical and you're still going through the entire
which we
going,
should be doing. We shouldn't be going should, off either.
Right. Okay. You know, there's practice makes perfect. The more you do it, the better you get.
Yeah.
And so when you have to really apply that stuff, you're getting, you know, the shit is hitting the fan, and you have to act. You can't think in depth, you know, as much as, you know, the critical analysis could go on, then it pays off. Then there's no doubt in my mind that doing those skills repeatedly, keeping yourself limber in that thinking all pays off.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, I really, I sort of bristle at the idea of using people as guinea pigs, or the concept of using. And listen, we've all had students on the bus, and who do you? I mean, what's the big, you know, the inside joke on EMS is, you know, when you get the drunk, who starts the line on the drunk?
Yeah. I think the big catheter and all that good stuff, you know, it's like, right. And I've never been a fan of that type of stuff myself. Listen, I think we got somebody on hold here. Josh, let me see if you can bring him in real quick. I don't want my graphics and my switchboard are not showing, so I can't see the buttons. So I have to click by memory. Let's see if I'll do it.
Hello.
Hello. Hey, Tim. How you doing?
Okay, how are you?
All right. I got a little problem getting in there. I couldn't see my button that said live for some reason. So, Tim, let me ask you. I don't know if you've been listening at all so far, but, I mean, do you subscribe to that mentality of, you know, if it wasn't for the frequent flyers, if it wasn't for the sort of bullshit kind of calls that it's that that's job security for us?
I don't think it's really job security. It does allow some places to keep their numbers up, number of employees,
yeah,
because
that's
they're
true.
Doing a lot of stuff. Look at Philadelphia. They can staff their trucks appropriately. They're anywhere between 100 and 200 medics short, but they have lots of calls, and most of the stuff, you see them hop out of the truck, get the wheelchair, bring the patient into the hospital on the wheelchair, because they're not patients who really need a paramedic.
Right.
You know, Tim, and that's an interesting thing, because you'd think in a system that was overburdened, that had a lack of resources, would sort of down triage things so they could, you know, get not be as taxing on the extended resources in the first place. But nobody seems to put it in. Nobody seems to do that. They seem to always up triage, and it's not a matter of what resources they have. You know, it's a matter of the stupidity of the filtering system that dispatches the call.
Well, it's political.
The P word.
Yeah, well, you've got people who are making decisions purely to play to their political base, not because of good patient care or anything else. And there are a lot of things that they could do better, but, you know, they're not motivated to. You know, look at Detroit when they got their report showing that their resuscitation rate was essentially zero. Nobody did a thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say, hey, this is horrible. This is a tragedy. We should not have such a ridiculously low resuscitation rate. Look at, you know, places like Lake Sumter, Florida, where they're up at 50%.
But how much does that have to do with both a little bit of the education, and I know education definitely affects resuscitation rates, but, you know, they have an older population, which tends to have a higher resuscitation rate in the first place.
Why wouldn't the younger population have a higher resuscitation rate?
You talk about Florida,
Josh? If you're assuming that there are trauma arrests, I don't know what the rate of trauma arrest was. I just know that their resuscitation rate was less than 1%. The thing is, nobody did anything about it. There's a lot that you can do. You know, there are many different ways that you can work on the resuscitation rate. The response is not to say, if you're Bart Simpson, yeah, but that was the response. It's not.
Well, what can you do?
Lake Sumter has an ideal population to drop dead and be resuscitated. The problem was that Detroit wasn't doing anything and decided that they wanted to continue not doing anything. And they did.
But is that because of their own staffing, like you mentioned with Philadelphia, you think? They don't have the equipment and staff, or is it the call volume, like you said, with Philadelphia, where they're just getting people and, you know, kind of handling these nonsense calls, you know, within the system and wheeling them into the hospitals in wheelchairs?
Well,
like, it sounds like
really
Florida.
What I was saying about Philadelphia. What I was saying is that they're overburdened. A lot of the calls are calls that don't require a paramedic, and they're very understaffed. There are a lot of things they could do to address that, but they don't address it because, politicians don't understand EMS, and it's not something that plays well to the voters. Voters don't know, so why do something about it?
I don't think the voters care either, honestly.
I mean, look at it, I think they look at it.
Well,
like
that was
a lot
the thing
of
in Detroit. You would think that when USA Today does a major story like that, that people would pay attention, and nobody cared in Detroit.
Yeah, it went to the wayside.
And that was
you know what? They have a lot
thing.
Of other. They had a lot of other issues, you know, going on, Tim, that sort of trumped those. You know, the idea of one of the highest unemployment rates in the country, the idea of, you know, more homes going underwater. I mean, you know, isn't
this was
Detroit the area 10
years
where they started
ago,
bulldozing?
So that wasn't going on at the time. I think it was 2005.
Well, maybe they were leading the country in that. You know what?
Detroit has
I think
been
you have
leading
a
the
point.
Country
Why
in unemployment
you...
and urban blight and stuff like that. But still, even where you
but you're right.
have that, somebody should be saying, we need to address this. There are going to be political problems for every city, every municipality. They're going to have to deal with that. But to just completely ignore it is... things are only going to get worse unless it's by pure random variation that somehow the numbers get better.
Right, right. You know, you definitely want an advocate coming out and saying, look, these statistics are showing that there's something broken in the system and it's affecting the welfare of the citizens of this city. Or this area, and somebody should be sort of tooting the horn on that. But you're right, you know, it gets either downplayed, and if the politicians aren't behind it, they don't give a crap.
Well, a lot of times politicians don't know what works. Look at how few people in EMS understand EMS.
Don't start.
Yeah, I think, you know, you talk about, you know, learning to love all these types of calls, and at the same time, it's like you talk to people outside of EMS, and all they think of is, well, you know, they call 911, just take them to the hospital. They're not looking at things like you mentioned, you know, resuscitation rates and overburden the system and the amount of personnel that are out there available to handle all these types of calls. But you do have people within even EMS who take this mindset of, well, if it wasn't for, you know, all these nonsense calls, we wouldn't have a job. It's job security, you know. I'm not a big subscriber.
God, I hate
to that.
That.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that statement. But it is a reality, I think, and I don't see it kind of going away anytime soon.
I think the reality is that the way EMS sold to the public and the way the way all response is sold to the public is not the quality of the response, not what you're getting at your door, not the success rate of what care is being delivered, but how fast you can get it there. So, you know, I mean, if you want to use the analogy of ice cream, they don't give a shit of what flavor it is. They don't give a shit that it's melted out of the cup. They don't give a crap. It's even moldy for that. They just want to know that it's still frozen when you get it.
But if the problem is that we're catering to the lowest common denominator, the person who says, I just want to go to the emergency department and get my Percocet and get cleaned up and get a meal out of it, we're not really providing job security. We're just dumbing ourselves down to the same level. And if anybody wises up, then it's no longer job security. And, you know, why are we not trying to do something like community paramedicine to try to divert these patients out of the emergency department where they're interfering with the care of other patients?
And yeah, but what I'm trying to say, Tim, I'm trying to say, and maybe I'm not making it the point, is that it's not job security. That the only thing that is, you know, if quality of care or what was delivered was any part of the argument, I would agree with that. But it never is part of the argument. The only thing you see listed time and time again on stats of response is how fast you get there. I mean, if it turns
it doesn't
into
really matter except for cardiac arrest.
Yeah, and then and, you know, it's all about a lot of the stuff is about time. How long does it get there? Get to the hospital? How long you're on scene for? How long you know your turnaround time inside the hospital? That seems to be what is measured more than anything else. You know, I think the community paramedicine thing is a key thing. What's that?
Because you don't think it can be, you mean? It's because they can be, not the only things that can be measured, but they can be measured easily.
Yeah.
And we don't go for thinking abstract thoughts. We just go for the easy, lowest common denominator thoughts. Oh, I'll get the ambulance there quickly, therefore we have to get them there within 7:59 or 8:59, depending on who you listen to.
Uh-huh.
And it's ridiculous because there is no evidence to show that either of those times is meaningful. The only thing that matters time-wise is getting somebody to start compressing the chest as quickly as possible. Seattle did a great job of getting their community to do CPR. They taught the community. They said, we're not going to spend all of our money on new gadgets and stuff like that. We're going to educate the community to provide immediate care. And I think that's the biggest factor in their resuscitation rates. But they also don't have a lot of paramedics. So it takes longer for a paramedic to get on the scene because the paramedic is not the important one in resuscitation. So,
right.
You know, it doesn't affect the outcome.
Right.
And for
and you've made that point
where response time doesn't matter, they're getting there and they're getting a lot more experience. So, you know, throwing a bunch of, if you have every person on every piece of apparatus, a paramedic, you get a lot of inexperienced paramedics and you get poor care.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of places that, you know, you get on call and there's like between the ambulance and the engine, you've got four to five paramedics that are on scene for one patient. And I kind of blows
yeah, so
away.
Who's getting experience out of that?
Yeah, I mean, you get
Nobody's getting any experience except for the one who's actually providing the treatment to the patient.
Right.
And do you need to have an IV endotracheal tube done at once? No.
Yeah.
It would look kind of crazy if you did.
It seems almost as if we went from years ago, the you call, we haul type mentality with not a lot of care and not a lot of ability for care to be given to patients, to now where that mentality is sort of coming back, where it's all timed and the patient's expecting and everybody else is sort of expecting it, but yet we can do so much more and we're almost expected to do more. And if we don't accomplish things, we end up sort of getting called on a carpet because we didn't get to everything that we should have done. You know, it's like we're expected to do the same sort of, rapid turnaround, you know, these low emergent patients, and but yet still provide all this other care along with it. You know, this critical care, this IV saline lock, EKG on every patient that you encounter, you know, just because they called 911, that immediately entitles them to this entire workup, you know.
If we looked at the outcomes to find out what is the best way to provide care, then we would have something better to go on. But nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to trust research to give them answers.
Instead, I don't think it's a matter of wanting to trust research, Tim.
They want to support their own biases.
I think there's no money there.
Research contradicts people's bias. Well, yeah, there's no money there, but we don't care enough about what the truth is to find out. And we want to defend our biases. And if we look at research, if we study this in a way that actually answers questions, then some people will have their biases shattered. And they would rather harm patients than see that happen. Because too important to them.
I've seen that too many times happen where there's been suggestions for change and changes, either whether it's equipment, whether it's the way the two paramedic to one medic, one EMT response, and how whenever that comes about, it's like everybody, the powers that be or the people that have some sort of significant input are just, you know, like you said, Tim, they've got their biases and they sort of get the wagons and start circling the wagons and protecting their little rice bowl, not to change things, you know, based on whether it's maybe it's research, maybe it's based on just doing it better or doing it what's been, you know, what another area might be doing that seems to be working. There's immediate resistance to any of that, you know. It's like everybody just wants to keep going, you know, sort of just keep doing as they've been doing. And I think that even this the community paramedicine thing is a great thing that's trying to get going. I just feel like that's the type of thing that I don't think it's understood enough, you know.
Well, I think that there's two barriers to that being widely adopted. And one of them in terms of the research end and the realization of what the effectiveness is that think of it, most of this EMS first response, EMS is almost a stepping stone for a lot of people. It's not a final destination. It's not a career. It's the way to another career. So, you know, they're not interested in changing the world or really making things more efficient. They're more interested in, you know, surviving what they're doing, getting a couple of gold stars under their belt, and moving on. And I think that's a major barrier.
Yeah, I think a lot of people also get into EMS thinking that it will be a career, and then they realize how limited we are by the various protocols and procedures and how much they interfere with providing good patient care, and they decide, well, I'm going to do something else like nursing or go to medical school or go into an entirely different field. I know a lot of people who have left EMS to go into computer programming and stuff like that say, I'm tired of working for so little money.
That's a big one. The computer programming seems to be a big one that people go from EMS to go do that. That's weird. I had a partner that did, like you said, Tim, he went from being a medic and he went to go to medical school because he felt he had, like you said, no control. He felt limited with what was going on. And, you know, he liked being a medic, but, you know, again, he's thinking future-wise of a young guy. And he got out young, you know. I mean, think about myself. It's depressing thinking about, you know.
It's not that, you know, or they go to nursing or, you know, I mean, we talk about it as career paths. There is no career path. So where do people go? They go nursing or PA. Yeah. Or if they're lucky enough and have the resources, they go to medical school.
Yeah. Let me just take a break, guys. Let me just mention the sponsor real quick, because we talk a lot about tonight about, you know, paramedics and, you know, how many there are. And if you do have paramedics at your agency or EMTs, it's important, of course, to schedule them. So EMS Manager does just that. They are an employee scheduling and management software company. And you should go try to check out the software. It's free.
You can get a free trial. It's customizable. It's at emsmanager.net. They've got mobile phone apps, web apps. You can get it from your smartphone. Any sort of web interface you have, they can. You can go ahead and view the software. It's all online. It's up in the cloud, and the cloud makes it easy for updates. It makes it easy for keeping down costs as far as IT costs go, and that makes it also valuable because they actually price the software based on the size of an organization. So this way, it's always affordable. And it's also in the cloud, guys, like I said, so there's not a lot of IT costs going on with that as well, which lets them be able to price it just right. So, again, I mentioned this before, too, which is, I think, is a key point with anything you kind of get out there, is that you might get the software, you might get a platform, but with EMS Manager, they have the free training, the free tech support, free system software updates, and it's all great that comes along with the entire package. You have to pay for the software and then start having all those little extra charges lumped on in there for updates and tech support and all that stuff. So if you want to try to check it out for your system, your organization, go check them out. Again, it's free. It's a customizable trial. It's emsmanager.net. And I also just want to take a quick moment here just to thank them for sponsoring EMS Office Hours, as well as a lot of the other favorite EMS programs that are out there from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support us and EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and all the support of what we do here on the podcast. So show your support for them, guys. Go take a few minutes. Check out their free trial at emsmanager.net. It's a LATEX EMS Manager. It's for online employee scheduling and workforce management. It's, again, guys, emsmanager.net. And, of course, I'll have a link in the show notes to go check them out as well. So, again, thank you for sponsoring the show. I really appreciate it. I did play around a little bit. My free trial expired, but I encourage everyone to go check that out. So, I know that I don't want to beat the drum here too crazy with the bullshit calls and non-emergent versus emergent calls. I'm just wondering, Tim and Josh, both of you guys, if you think when we get those calls, like I said, and Tim, you didn't kind of weigh in too much on this, but and I hate to use the word guinea pig, but it's sort of, I guess people are going to maybe take it like that. But you get the calls on a non-emergent. I mean, shouldn't we be taking those opportunities on those non-emergent patients to sort of hone our skills a little bit? I mean, they call us. I'm not saying do things that are unnecessary, but, hone our skills a little bit so that when you do get that critical call, you're more comfortable in what you're doing. Or that should just, should that just be part of the training?
Or IV skills, or intubation skills, or cricothyrotomy skills?
Well, I don't know about cricothyrotomy. I think we're on the emergency part. I'll do the bullshit at that point.
Hey, next year it's going to come chest
but
tubes.
For me, I think the main thing probably is probably assessment skills. I think too often you get these calls and
people
just
How do you know that the patient doesn't deserve treatment if you don't do a full assessment?
Yeah, and this is what I'm saying. I think a lot of times when you get the calls like this, you get the call that either comes over and it sounds like it's not an emergency call. You get there and your initial impression is not really an emergency. If you just put them on the stretcher and you don't do the full evaluation, like you said, you might not catch on something. And this is something that I've tried to push on people that I work with, especially with elderly patients too. What's that?
I can't believe you said that.
I didn't hear what he said.
I didn't hear. He didn't say. I don't think he. I think it was a distortion of the line. But I can't believe you said ugly patients too.
Elderly. He said.
Oh, it's distortion in the line. I'm sorry. It would have been funnier if you said and even get ugly patients as well. I'm sorry. Whatever.
We never have ugly patients.
Yeah.
All of our patients are beautiful, they're young, and they're smarter than
8% body fat. Right. Absolutely.
One of the problems we have in EMS is that we tend to accept refusals from patients who we shouldn't accept refusals from. They make for some interesting blog posts, like patient who has chest pain and the paramedic comes in and says, take some Tums, you have indigestion. Like, what are you thinking? Who ever taught you to think that way? But there are people in EMS who do think that way. So the one time I am in favor of medical command contact is for refusals, because it's something that I have seen where, you know, it's not something that just happens in these occasional news stories where they're rare events, but there are people who just don't get it. I had one guy who was the quality control director for a company. He was orienting me to the job. We go out and find a drunk who tumbled down a flight of stairs. He walked the guy back up, put him in bed, and said, see you later.
I do think that people with the RMA, they feel that they definitely are too quick to accept it or even too fast to sort of almost guide the patient along the line of getting them to refuse. You know, like you said, you have chest pain, or just take it to indigestion, you know, take a Tums.
What is the full assessment for chest pain in the emergency department? Is any physician going to have a patient refuse if they can avoid it without doing serial troponins on them? Not just one troponin level, but over a period of time, repeat the troponin. Doesn't matter if the patient is 40 years old. There's a paper that just came out a little while ago, and Tom Boutelet linked to it. It showed that as patients age, once you get up over 80 years old, only about half of STEMIs present with chest pain. But when you're down in the 18 to 30-year-old range, it's up around 90%. So as we age, and it's a gradual, steady decline, the number of other causes of, or the other symptoms of STEMI increase. So syncope, weakness, dizziness, tiredness, which is a big one more with women who present atypically more often. But over 80 years old, half of the patients are going to be atypical presentations. And if you think that it's just chest pain, you're missing out on a huge amount of patients who need to have a 12-lead done. For STEMI.
Yeah, it's going to be the big one. I find a lot of people are so fast to try to RMA them, because by the time you get there, they're back to their normal state, and they don't want to go to the hospital. But you know, there's a reason why they did have that episode. And I find way too many people that'll even accept the refusal without even doing an EKG. I had a partner once that the patient was refusing. I was like, well, let's just do an EKG. And she looked at me like I had 10 heads. Like, what are you doing that for? Just get the RMA. And I'm looking at it like, well, because you know, I don't know, this guy could be having a block or who knows what, and you're not going to see it by just sitting here talking to him, you know. It just really does, you know. There are things like that, and again, like you said, not all MIs are going to have that classic appearance, and like you said, the hospitals.
But what kind of magic powers do they think they have that they're going to be able to figure out what the cause of a syncope is without doing a good assessment?
I think when you're RMAing somebody and you're not and you don't do an assessment, that's just a lack of common sense, and there's no other way to put it. You know, you have somebody who had something that was in their world. You know, we always have to go by that that lowest common denominator, that somebody had an incident that in their world was serious enough that they wanted external help to come. At that point in time, it's in our hands and our judgment to say whether or not, you know,
right. To say we
need to act.
Shit.
We need to act, or is this really, you know, guys, this is really education on the end user that's the problem. You know, you need to know the appropriate times to call an ambulance. And part of the problem is our opportunity to for those teachable moments are few and far between, because you can't really tell a person, regardless of if it's a stomach ache or it's a splinter, that this is not appropriate for an ambulance. And I'm sorry that you're too dumb to know the difference of what a true medical call is. I mean, you really can't approach it that way. And the side
but
of
syncope is not that call.
Exactly.
If
and
I have somebody who wants to refuse as a syncope patient, I am going to do an assessment for stroke, because it could be a TIA, and it could be just this was the initial presentation of the stroke, and they may have a deficit that I'm not going to find unless I do that assessment.
I'm not arguing any of that.
A heart attack. That is.
I'm not arguing any of that.
It could be that they're dehydrated. It could be a dozen other
things. Once again, I agree. I agree. Okay, you're not getting a disagreement from me on that.
And this is where if they want to refuse, this is where I want to get the doctor on the line to talk to them, because a lot of the times they'll say, oh, doctor, you want me to go to the hospital? Absolutely, doctor. Whatever you say. It not only saves me a lot of time.
You'll still get the person who says, I don't care what the doctor says, I'm not going. And
well, at some point, you can't spend all day with them, though. But
we got to backtrack to say, you know, we're addressing two things here. One is the clinician saying, you know what, I think you should go to the hospital, and the patient saying, I refuse. And the other, which is sounds almost like laziness or a lack of interest or a lack of professionalism, on if you want to go that far, where they're saying you don't really
not
need
professionalism. It's a lack of intelligence.
Well, I mean, who the hell would tell a patient that wants to go to the hospital you really don't need to go to the hospital? I mean, what person in their right
mind?
There
are a lot of people out there who do that. They view their job as talking the patient out of going.
You know what? They don't stay in the job too long, because that eventually
actually they do.
That's
there are places around me where there are places around me where there are a lot of people like that. They tend to end up in the same agency. They know by looking at the patient that there's nothing real going on.
They roll the dice.
And
yeah, but that's what it is.
And eventually it will get them.
Yeah,
and it's just stupid, and it's more. You know what? If you're doing an RMA and you have any desire for a survivable number going into that, going into giving these RMAs, you're going to be careful how you write that up. You know, you're going to really do a thorough assessment. You're going to document that assessment, and you're going to document that the patient was advised, understood, and refused treatment and further treatment and transport to a care facility. You're going to document that.
But we don't get sued
a lot. RMAs are more work. You know what?
I find you more work myself, too. Exactly.
You want to go? Come on. You know, it's...
You called us to get there. Let's go to the hospital. I find the same thing where the RMA is more... It's more work to try to RMA somebody and sit there and try to cover your ass on everything that you wanted to do or could have done than to just tell them, let's go to the hospital, you do your assessment, and, you know, you talk about learning to love those types of calls that don't really present as a big emergency. Sometimes you go and you do your assessment, and you're surprised that you find something is really going on with the patient that you might not have seen had you just treated it as nonsense and just sort of popped them on the stretcher and took them to the hospital.
And any practitioner
that's
worth their salt is going to treat it that way too. I think what you were saying earlier.
We don't have a lot who are worth their salt. But many of these people will be the same people who insist on immobilizing everybody because they don't want to get in trouble. So you wonder how you get those two ridiculous thoughts mixed in the same person.
Right, the same person that
you
want
to harm somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
To avoid getting in trouble. Yet when you have somebody who has a much greater chance of having something bad happen, all of a sudden you're cavalier about it. Oh, I'm not going to do an assessment.
Well, maybe because they protocol. Maybe because they
I'm
feel the
talk them into a refusal.
Maybe because they feel the motor vehicle accident got a higher probability of ending up in court than grandma that passed out at 2 a.m. when she went to the bathroom.
They're probably right.
You know,
because lawyers look at motor vehicle collisions, and they should probably be looking at refusals if they
the
want
really,
to find a new
really
way to make
in.
Money.
part of the problem is how we value
to deal with the lawyers.
Right.
Because the lawyers don't make things better. This has been studied. And if lawyers made things better, then if you had a problem with a bad outcome, you wouldn't have the judges seal the facts of the case. It would be published as something that is of public interest. If this company is providing bad care, we need to know about it. If this drug manufacturer is making a dangerous drug, we need to know about it. But a lot of these cases get sealed, and it's nonsense. If
lawyers claim that they're
actually doing public good, then they can't accept these cases as sealed from the public unless there's something extraordinary about them. But it's not the extraordinary case that
gets
sealed.
But they're not there doing public good, Tim. It's not about public good. It's about where the money is.
That's their argument. That's what their argument is. And you get people like John Edwards, who makes a fortune going after obstetricians for something that is not within the control of the obstetrician.
Right.
Saying a bad outcome is
where the money is.
Malpractice, which it isn't.
But it's also a matter of how society judges the value of a person's life. If you deal, we're in a society that if somebody is just born, they have their whole life ahead of you. That is, regardless of what genetic predisposition that they had in the first place, there is an entire world of productivity ahead of them. Because you can't tell that somebody's not going to be productive. However, when somebody's 80 years old,
people don't understand cause and effect. If people understood cause and effect, they wouldn't fall for the nonsense that lawyers present them with.
Yeah, well, and then you have the 80-year-old.
And giving them a young patient just allows them to add more zeros to the number. But the problem is that they come up with the wrong decision. They say, oh, there's a cause, something happened after it.
Lawyers don't make
or
the decision.
There's something that happened, something happened before it, therefore it must have caused it.
But lawyers aren't
and
making that decision.
We have
jury and the judge, right?
No, but they're presenting
so
the information. We have
they're
an adversarial system, which is, and we don't have enough lawyers, or we don't have lawyers doing it effectively in the opposite direction. Most of the malpractice cases will get decided for the defendant, but you're still spending a huge amount of money to defend against something that where you did nothing wrong. And even doctors do not understand cause and effect. Look at all the treatments that are promoted that have no benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen, guys.
Why
just
tell people to take a new drug?
Because it's more expensive. And the sales, they need the sales.
Why not take a safer drug where we know more about the side effects and it costs less and the doctors are more familiar with it. No, we'll take a brand new drug that's untested and will probably be recalled or has a higher chance of being recalled. Because once a drug's been out for a few years, it's unlikely to be recalled. It's the new drugs that get recalled.
Listen, guys, let me wrap it up there because I don't want to get on to another topic, and we only have another couple minutes here. So, Tim, thanks for calling in. As always, I appreciate it. Great feedback. I enjoy.
Thank you.
Enjoy your.
I've got a new podcast too.
You do?
Yep. Over at Standing Orders.
Okay.
Brad Buck and Matt Foltz decided to set me up with Rogue Medic Rants.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
Do you have a set date on the set time or anything? Or
Wednesday, I think, or last Thursday, they put up the first podcast.
So you're pre-recording it and then they're putting it up?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's already, the first one is already up.
Okay.
It's so at roguemedic.emsstandingorders.com.
Okay.
We'll put up that link.
Yeah, I'll,
Tim, are you having it as a discussion format where you'll have people on with you and discussing the topic? Or is this...
I will probably do some of that, but it's the first one is just me talking for about 15 minutes on Excited Delirium.
Oh, cool.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, definitely.
And then there's a bit of an introduction on this one because they're explaining what it is, and the introduction will maybe completely disappear. Depends.
Gotcha.
And then we're going, the three of us will be down Gathering of Eagles in Dallas, so we'll probably do some podcasting from down there.
Oh,
maybe
good news.
I will... corral some doctors into talking about whatever they're presenting on at Gathering of Eagles. I expect that there will be a lot of discussion of spinal immobilization.
Yeah.
One state just decided that they were going to follow the National Association of EMS Physicians draft policy on spinal immobilization, which says that it's perfectly appropriate to put a patient on the stretcher with or without a collar and transport them not on a board to the trauma center or to the emergency department. And
the horror.
That was something that the National Association of EMS Physicians didn't approve. They went along with the American College of Surgeons protocol on it, which said we still want to put them on a board, even though there's no reason to think that putting them on a board does anything beneficial.
Unreal. Well, that's good to know, Tim. I mean, I'll put that in the show notes. I'll link it to the show notes that people go take a look at that.
Thank you.
I'm sure some pretty good information here, without a doubt. All right, guys. That's it for tonight. Hopefully, we'll see you both here next week. And again, I'll put everybody's links in the show notes so people can go check yous out. So have a great night.
Thanks. You have a good night, too.
All right.
Take it easy. Take care, Tim.
Just want to mention a couple of new Twitter followers real quick. I got Ginger Denton, Bill Carey, and Bill Adams. Not too many new followers this week. I'm a little disappointed in that. But three is better than none. So go check them out over on Twitter. Follow them. Tell them that EMS Safe sent you. That's my Twitter handle. Don't forget to check out my main website, guys, at emsseo.com for some study and training resources. And also Josh as well. We mentioned him in the beginning, but go check out wantnew.com as well for Josh's one-of-a-kind oxygen wrenches.
Best damn oxygen wrench made.
Yeah, shut up, Josh. All right, guys, that's it. Next week, as always, Jim Hoffman for EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.